Hey, it's Nishant, and welcome to Higher IQ. It's Wednesday, June 24th. Yesterday, the Senate passed a housing affordability bill 85-5. 85-5. When was the last time 85 senators agreed on anything? The bill they passed limits Wall Street investors from buying single-family homes and makes it easier to build new ones. The headlines are all about the Wall Street part, because BlackRock is buying your house is a great villain story, and I bought it too. I've lived in Milwaukee, Atlanta, and now in the Bay Area, and have always rented. The idea of buying a home here feels like something that happens to other people. So when I hear that hedge funds are scooping up houses in bulk, that feels like the answer and the reason that I can't buy a house. Except when I actually looked at the numbers, the Wall Street story is mostly a distraction. Institutional investors own about 3% of single-family rental homes nationally. Only 3%. Economists across the political spectrum are nearly unanimous that corporate investors are not the primary cause of the housing crisis. They're just a symptom of it. The real reason that you probably can't afford a house is less dramatic and harder to fix, and it has almost nothing to do with Wall Street. The Wall Street angle isn't completely wrong, so let me be fair about where it does apply. After the 2008 financial crisis, home prices collapsed and private equity firms, led by Blackstone, saw an opportunity. They created companies like Invitation Homes to buy foreclosed single-family homes in bulk at very depressed prices, renovating them, and then they would rent them out. The purchases were concentrated in Sun Belt cities, so think Atlanta, Phoenix, Orlando, Tampa, and Las Vegas. In some of those specific markets, institutional buyers account for up to 10% of home purchases, which is enough to move prices and reduce inventory for individual buyers. The criticism is real in those pockets. Invitation Homes was hit with the settlement by California's Attorney General for allegedly price gouging tenants and illegally raising rents on over 1,900 properties. Tenants in corporate-owned rentals report worse conditions and less responsive management than mom-and-pop landlords, and the optics are terrible. A Wall Street firm buying the house you wanted to raise your family in and then renting it back to you at a premium feels like the system working against you in the most personal way possible. But nationally, the numbers don't support the narrative. Large institutional investors own roughly 3% of single-family rental homes. 93% are owned by small operators, individuals, and families who own 1 to 9 properties. A housing researcher quoted in the National Post put it clearly, "Any segment that owns such a small percentage of the market cannot have that much of an impact on prices, except in a handful of communities with unusually high concentration." A UC Riverside professor called the political focus on Wall Street investors appearing to do something without actually doing anything. So, if Wall Street isn't the main problem, then what is? The United States is short somewhere between 2 and 4 million homes, and that number is not disputed by anyone serious. Since the 2008 crash wiped out the construction industry, housing starts never fully recovered. Builders went bankrupt. Skilled laborers left the industry and never came back. And for over a decade, we've been building fewer homes than the population growth demands. The math is simple. More people need homes than there are homes available. So when demand exceeds supply, what do you think happens? Prices go up. That's not Wall Street. That's just basic economics. But the reason that we're not building enough homes is where it gets interesting. And it's the part that nobody in Congress wants to talk about because the villain isn't the hedge fund. It's the voters. Most of America's most expensive housing markets are expensive because local zoning laws make it illegal to build enough housing. Single-family zoning, which means you can only build one house per lot no matter how big the lot is, covers roughly 75% of residential land in most major American cities. You can't build a duplex. You can't build a small apartment building. You can't build a townhouse. The law says one house, one lot. And if the neighborhood is already built out, no new supply can be added. On top of single-family zoning, there are minimum lot sizes that prevent smaller homes on smaller parcels, setback requirements that dictate how far from the property line you can build, height restrictions that prevent anything taller than 2 or 3 stories. parking minimums that require developers to build expensive parking structures, even in transit-rich areas, and environmental review processes that can delay a project for years, even when nobody actually objects to it. Each of these regulations sounds reasonable in isolation, but together, they create a system where building new housing in the places that people want to live in most is extraordinarily difficult, slow, and expensive. California is the most extreme example, and unfortunately, it's where I live. The median home price in the Bay Area is over $1.2 million. The state has been underbuilding for decades, and every time someone proposes higher density housing in an established neighborhood, the existing homeowners show up at the zoning board meeting and fight it. This is the part that makes the housing crisis different from most of the other problems we cover on Higher IQ, and it's the part that also makes it so hard to fix. Two-thirds of American households own their own homes. For most of those families, their home is their single largest financial asset. So when home prices go up, their net worth also goes up. When home prices go down, they feel poorer, they can't refinance, and in extreme cases, they end up underwater on their mortgage. Existing homeowners are then financially incentivized to restrict new housing supply in their area because more homes means more supply, and more supply means lower prices. So guess what? Existing homeowners decide to vote. They vote in local elections at much higher rates than renters. They show up at zoning board meetings. They organize neighborhood associations. They write letters to city council members. They vote against rezoning proposals, against affordable housing developments, against anything that might change the character of their neighborhood or, let's be real, reduce the value of their property. This is called NIMBYism. N-I-M-B-Y. It's an acronym for Not In My Backyard, and it's the single most powerful force in American housing policy. The system is designed by homeowners for homeowners, against renters and first-time buyers. The people who need housing the most have the least political power to create it. The people who benefit from scarcity have every incentive to maintain it. And because zoning is a local issue decided by local governments, the federal government, including the Senate bill that passed yesterday, has limited ability to override it. And this is what makes the housing crisis a path dependency problem, the same concept we covered yesterday with the QWERTY keyboard. Single-family zoning was established in most American cities in the early 20th century, partly for legitimate planning reasons and partly, if we're being honest, to keep certain neighborhoods racially and economically segregated. 100 years later, the zoning is still there, the homeowners who benefit from it will fight any change, and the cost of unwinding it is so high that most politicians won't even try. We're locked into a housing system that was designed for a different era, just like we're locked into a keyboard layout designed for a different machine. The Senate bill that passed 85-5 addresses the Wall Street piece, which is 3% of the problem, and includes provisions to make building easier, which is closer to the real issue. Whether those provisions survive the House and actually change local zoning practices is another question entirely. California has started pushing state-level mandates to override local zoning restrictions, which is kind of top-down intervention the problem probably requires. But telling homeowners that their neighborhood is about to get denser and their property values might decrease is one of the least popular things a politician can do, which is probably why so few actually do it. So if you're in Zillow and cannot believe the prices of the houses that you're seeing, here's what you should think about. The Senate just passed a housing bill 85-5 that restricts Wall Street from buying single-family homes. The Wall Street angle makes for a great headline, but institutional investors own about 3% of single-family rentals nationally. Economists unanimously say that they're a symptom, not the cause. The real issue is that the U.S. is short 2 to 4 million homes, and we're not building enough because local zoning laws make it illegal to build densely in most of the places that people actually want to live. Single-family zoning covers roughly 75% of residential land in major cities. The people who benefit from restricted supply are existing homeowners, who are also the people who vote in the local elections where zoning decisions are made. The villain isn't BlackRock. It's a system designed by people who already own homes for the people who already own homes, at the expense of everyone else trying to buy their first one. If you are an existing homeowner, I'm really not trying to call you out, but it is important to understand what voting against building new housing actually does to the system. The Senate bill is a good start, Whether it changes anything depends on whether local governments are willing to let people build and whether the homeowners who show up at the zoning meetings are willing to let them. So if you are one of them, maybe think about it when you make your next voting decision. Stay informed, stay curious, and we'll see you tomorrow.